Ladies and gentlemen, sports fans alike, welcome to another edition of Bill Swirsky, Sports Talk Chicago, one of the couple, two, three best podcasts around. So sit back, grab yourself a cold one and a Pola sausage, park your keister in the French room, and listen to Bill Swirsky, Sports Talk Chicago.
In Chicago, you know that all sports rock. The Bears, Hawks, Bulls, Cubs, and Sox. Pick your favorite, you can choose. As long as the Packers lose. For everything you need to know, it's Bill Swirsky, Sports Talk Chicago. Bill Swirsky, Sports Talk Chicago.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Bill Swirsky, Sports Talk Chicago. This is your hosts, Alex and Sean. On this episode, we've got the Bears back to a dominating D. Cubs have ups, Cubs have downs, but unlike Vontae Davis, we won't quit halfway through. So,
zing.
Zing. But before we get to that, I'd like to thank our sponsor, the Rockford Ice Hogs. If you're not familiar with the Rockford Ice Hogs, they're the AHL minor league affiliate of the Chicago Blackhawks. What does that mean for you? You get to see the stars of tomorrow today at family-friendly, affordable prices. I talk to a lot of Blackhawk fans. They love the team. They want to go to more games. It is just very expensive, especially if you have a family to take everybody there. You got to get tickets. You got to pay for parking. You got to feed everybody. Oh, little Susie wants a souvenir. Hell, it's going to set you back a lot of money. But guess what? The minor league team of the Blackhawks is less than an hour and a half from the city in beautiful downtown Rockford, Illinois at the BMO Harris Bank Center. It is a lot of fun, and it is a very affordable ticket starting at just $10. The season is starting very soon, so head on over to icehogs.com. Tell them Swirsky Sports sent you. Alex.
That's my name.
We have a lot to unpack in this show.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think there is a certain football game that I'm actually happy to talk about this week around.
I mean, I have some nitpick, but overall, I'm very happy with the result.
Yeah, I mean, obviously nothing was perfect, but hey, they're in the win column. That's what's really important.
So do we talk about that football game or do we talk a little baseball first?
I guess we could get baseball out of the way, save the best for last.
All right. So this week, we're sort of winding down the season for the Cubs. It's been a lot tighter of a race than I think we wanted. I guess we sort of academically thought that we would have that kind of tight race, but I don't think it's a race that either one of us really wanted.
No, you want it to be as easy as possible, and unfortunately, with the Brewers playing as well as they have been, including against the Cubs lately, that race got a lot tighter. But, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, I mean, you know, some of the ups is the pitching staff has really found its groove and has been fantastic. Part of the downs is the offense has done the absolute opposite and is just digging themselves further and further into a hole.
It's kind of at the point where starters have to be pretty much perfect or they're not going to win. I mean, the Cubs are outside the first game against Arizona, and you hope that that first game can be a boost. Cubs are not hitting home runs out of the ballpark. I mean, obviously home runs are out of the ballpark for the most part, but they're not slugging the ball that much in general, home runs or not. Hitting a lot of weak ground balls, not really making solid contact, and unfortunately a lot of solid contact has been for outs, which is a little bit of bad luck. But yeah, I mean, overall, the offense is just really struggling.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've got some stats to just kind of put it into perspective. Where do I have this? So what's crazy is with two games left in this 30 games in 30 days stretch, the Cubs are 18-10, which, you know, you really pretty much have to be happy about that in a 30 game stretch that they could, potentially be 20-10. That's a better winning percentage than they have on the entire season. But the way they're doing it is just not really sustainable. The slash line in this 30-day stretch, the slash line as a team is I can't read my handwriting. Is this 218, 312, 398? That can't be that bad.
I mean, yeah. It wouldn't kind of surprise me if you're going over this stretch. They're not getting a lot of hits. They're not scoring a lot of runs, and they're not. I mean, it seems like they're still decent at drawing walks, but you're not seeing as many of those long, grindy at-bats. I mean, you finally saw it again in Arizona where they scored 5 runs, hit some home runs. But yeah, I mean, you just see so many innings where the Cubs are just hacking early and they're going 1-2-3 in just the blink of an eye.
Yeah, and the thing is after this bad stretch, which has lasted a long time now, we are really excited about 5 runs. 5 runs is you know, should be on, you know, if you look at a range of what you expect, 5 runs is like in that, the high end of that range. You know, so it's not like a lot of runs. It just compared to this team, I mean, they won a 3 game, or they won 2 out of 3 against Cincinnati by scoring 5 total runs in all 3 games. But,
you know, you got to give a lot of props to the pitching for pretty much getting those 2 wins. I mean, especially the second one where they won 1-0, you know, John Lester came up really big. The Cubs were very fortunate overall this weekend to not only just score 5 runs and win 2-3, but the Pirates beat the Brewers 2-3. So that really helped their magic number right there. That was very fortunate. I mean, you can look here and say, man, if the Cubs would have just hit more, this wouldn't be a race. But you could also say, with the way they have been hitting, because what they have been doing is the reality, that they're pretty lucky to be 2.5 up right now.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And further breaking down those numbers, I said, over the last 2 weeks, not including yesterday's game, over the last 2 weeks, the Cubs, as a team, their slash line is 215, 286, 301 for the worst slash line in baseball. That's worse than the Orioles. Eesh. That's worse than the White Sox. They also, in this 30-game stretch, have a 49% ground ball rate, which is worst in baseball, and a 30.4% fly ball rate, which is the worst in baseball.
Yeah, again, a lot of balls just hit weakly on the ground. How many home runs have they hit recently? You had 2 very big ones, one by Bryant, one by Baez in the first game in Arizona, but they only hit the one against the Reds. That was huge. That was the Ian Happ game-winning 3-run home run. And then against Milwaukee, I'm trying to think, did they hit a home run against Milwaukee? Because I legit can't remember if they did or didn't. I don't think they did.
I'm not recalling one.
Yeah, I'm not either.
But here's, until yesterday, prior to yesterday, this is, do you know when the last time Albert Almora hit a home run was?
Wasn't that against the Brewers in August?
August 15th.
Yeah.
Do you know when the last time Wilson Contreras hit a home run?
Early August.
August 1st.
Oof.
Do you know when the last time, I know that he's injured, but do you know when the last time Jason Hayward hit a home run?
Now that I don't know.
July 24th. Prior to yesterday, the last time Bryant hit a home run was July 20th. The last time Addison Russell hit a home run, June 29th.
I was there for that. That was his grand slam that was aided by the wind.
Yeah. You know, so the Cubs are not hitting home runs. They're not hitting at all. So how are they winning? And we mentioned it briefly, is pitching has been great. And prior to yesterday's game, over his last 6 starts, John Lester has a 1.73 ERA. Jose Quintana, over his last 5 starts, has a 1.84 ERA. And over his last 9 starts, Cole Hamels has a 1.57 ERA.
Not only are the ERAs good, but you're seeing them go deep into ball games. You're seeing them go 7 innings. I mean, Kyle Hendricks was 1 out away from a complete game in Arizona. Probably one of the best pitching performances by any Cub all year. So you're seeing more of that, which is much needed because we just found out that Brandon Morrow is not coming back. And then you have the Pedro Strop injury, and he's not going to be back until the postseason, really. So you're down your top two relievers in the back end of the bullpen. They need as much help as they could get from the rotation, and they're finally getting it. You just hope that this keeps up the rest of the way, because if it doesn't, there could be some big trouble.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I was going to talk about the Strop injury, but Brandon Morrow, we knew he was injured, and first we heard some bad news that, you know, he might not be back till the end of the season, and then there was word that he might be back soon, and Joe Maddon this morning was saying that he'd get an update when he got back to Chicago on Thursday, but he was hearing good things, and that he might be back soon. So we're like, I'm like, oh, okay. You know, you'll get the boost. You know, you got the bad news of Pedro Strop, but you'll get the good news of him Morrow back. And hopefully, you know, you can hold steady in that bullpen. But today, yeah, we get the news that they're shutting him down and he's done for the season. You won't have him back at all.
So if right now you're kind of looking at a postseason scenario, a potential postseason scenario for the bullpen, and this is if Pedro Strop returns, and I think it sounds like that's going to happen, but there's no guarantees. So let's just say best case scenario, he returns for the postseason. You're looking at Strop as probably the closer, him or Cishek. So you'd have Strop, Cishek towards the end, Carl Edwards, Chavez, Montgomery, because he's not going to be starting in the postseason, Justin Wilson, another candidate to be a late bullpen guy, and you could choose with De La Rosa or Rosario. It'd probably be wise to go with De La Rosa being a veteran in this case, but I mean, those right there are your pretty obvious options for a postseason bullpen without Brandon Morrow.
Without Brandon Morrow and with Strop up in the air, it's time for Carl Edwards to right his ship and show everybody the stuff he has and what he's able to do. Because if he goes out there and has no command, this Cubs team is in trouble. The way they're hitting and the bullpen injuries, and then having Edwards just, you know, losing the trust of Joe.
Oh, I mean, right now, I don't really trust Carl Edwards Jr. at all. And this was after he had a first half where he just dominated. He was incredible in the first half. Then he had the injury. Then he came back and still looked pretty good. But just like last year, the same thing happened again. Things started to fall apart. And as I say, every time I talk about Carl Edwards, you pretty much know which Carl Edwards you're going to get 2-3 pitches in. If he's throwing two pitches that are way up high or way outside, you know that he doesn't have it. But if he starts throwing strikes early on, then he does have it. His K rate in the first half was absurdly high. I mean, people couldn't touch the guy. Now, even when he's throwing strikes, he's not missing bats like he was. If you can get the Carl Edwards that was close to the first half, then that's a huge get, but we need to see that.
Yeah, I mean, and there's some blessings for this bullpen as well. I mean, Randy Rosario has been, you know, a godsend for this bullpen. I mean, is he a beast? No, but has he been fantastic compared to what our expectations were for him? Yes.
Oh yeah, I mean, he's had a lot of good moments. Don't get me wrong. He's looked
good. Yeah, he's had a lot of very good moments, and he's you know, he's going, you know, I honestly lean towards him in a playoff situation because I think he's done a lot of good things, and you know, I honestly trust him over a lot of guys. But the MVP, you know, I mean, I don't know, maybe not MVP, but a guy who's just been a fantastic pickup is Jesse Chavez.
Yes.
He became a Cub, only two pitchers have a higher WAR than he does for the Cubs. That's Hendricks and Hamels.
That's crazy.
So not Lester, not Quintana. it is Jesse Chavez. And Jesse Chavez has just been a huge boost, and you're not anywhere, you're not where you are if you're the Cubs in the standings without, picking up Jesse Chavez.
You look at the acquisitions they made during the season, not before the season, during the season. Obviously there's a number of them, but you got to just say that Cole Hamels has been the best starter and Jesse Chavez has been the best reliever. I mean, Kinsler has not worked out very well. So you definitely give a lot of credit to Chavez, and I don't think Kinsler is going to even be considered right now for the postseason roster, which is too bad because I expected him to be decent, but that hasn't worked out. Jesse Chavez, when they got him, I said, I kind of like this, and people were very meh about it, but hopefully he doesn't lose his mojo because he's done some great things here. I mean, heck, you could even argue to plug him in as a closer. And if you need him to go multiple innings, you can do that too. His versatility is great.
Yeah, and the crazy part is his stuff isn't the best stuff. It's just he goes out there and he challenges you, and he's a gutsy pitcher, and everything's coming up millhouse for him.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's not like he throws 99 or has a slider with unreal bite. Smart pitcher, locates well, and just gets the job done.
So let's talk about this Pedro Strop injury.
Yeah.
I'm sure everybody by now knows this, but, if you can give the scenario of how he got injured.
Yeah. So it was bases loaded, top of the 10th, Cubs had a run in. Pedro Strop had pitched an inning and two thirds, I believe. It was either an inning and a third or an inning and two thirds. Anyway, so Joe Maddon was going to use him in the bottom of the 10th to get the save. So he had him bat with the bases loaded. He swings, hits a ground ball over to third, and third baseman picks it up, scoops, throws over to home to get the first out, and then to first for the double play. As Pedro Strop is running, he hurts his hamstring on the base. So your best reliever hurt himself on the base pass, which is really something you never want or should hear. Our best reliever was injured on the base paths, and that is really aggravating.
It's especially aggravating because under no circumstance should he have been in that position. Is number one, as you said, he pitched over an inning. I think it was an inning and a third at that point. But
it was either an inning, a third, or inning in two thirds, but he came in before the ninth inning.
Yeah. And so he already pitched longer than he typically pitches, and you bring him out again. I think that was a bad idea. Number one. Number two is, you've got bases loaded with less than two outs. Statistically, you should score some runs. Is bring in a pinch hitter. And a third is typically you're like with a pitcher batting, the base is loaded and one out. You're like, okay, what's the worst that happens is he hits a soft grounder to the left side of the field. They get him double play and the inning's over. No. Is the worst is he does that and then comes up injured and you end up having to put in another pitcher anyway. You could have avoided all of this by putting in a pinch runner or having the pitcher bunt. If you have him, is you're not going to hit into a bunt double. You might, but it's just bunt. If you have to have him up at the plate.
Yeah, it was very unfortunate the way it played out. Or heck, even if he swung and hit it, Strop's instinct is to try to beat it out as a batter, and I can't be mad at him for that, but it probably would have been best if he were in that situation to just kind of jog it out. I mean, I can't be mad at Strop for that, but that's probably would have been a better scenario. The way I saw it is you pinch hit LaStella, you try to get some more runs, and you create breathing room for Randy Rosario. That's the scenario I wanted to see. Am I furious with Joe? I can't say that I am, because this is a very difficult situation to be in. You're playing a makeup game in the middle of a month stretch where you didn't get a day off. This is a very difficult situation to be in, but I still don't necessarily agree with the way he went about that inning. But yeah, there's nothing I could do about it.
No, I mean, nothing you can do. It is what it is. I mean, you know, another scenario is you could have sent him up there and be like, don't have the bat leave your shoulder. Just sit it up there. Stand up there.
Or don't even go up with the bat. Just stand just, there.
Well, at least then he's got to, attempt to pitch to you. But just take the pitches. If he strikes you out, he strikes you out. If he walks you, he walks you. But you don't swing. And we preserve you. But I mean, you know, hindsight is 20/20.
Yep, exactly.
Let's see. What else did I have here? Do you want to talk about Wilson Contreras?
Yeah, sure.
So Wilson Contreras hit a monster ball and watched it, and it didn't end up going out. And he, per a official baseball MLB tweet, he disrespected 90.
Yeah, isn't that cut 40, whoever said that?
Yeah, this it was bad. It was really bad. But I can get where he's coming from. Is somebody did the math on this, and this season, based on that launch angle and exit velocity, that was the only one that had those numbers that didn't go out of the park this season.
I don't know how the hell that stayed in play. I mean, it hit the bottom of the basket. And if that goes out, the Cubs probably do win that game in some form later on. But that was frustrating, because I don't know how the heck that didn't get out. I know the wind was kind of blowing in, but I didn't think it was blowing in that hard.
Yeah, it's crazy things happen. But, I mean, it was a dumb thing, and hopefully that doesn't end up hurting us here, but it's you hope he learns from it and doesn't happen again. But I don't know. It's it, you know, 99 times out of 100, that's a home run. it's not like it was a soft liner and that he stood there and watched. It was a monster hit.
Yeah, I just, the way I see it is, he owned up to it. People expressed their displeasure for it. You move on from it. You know, right now is not the time to be arguing or worrying about etiquette when you're trying to win a division. I mean, that's just my opinion. So you learn from it. You learn from your mistakes. You move on. And, you know, I just don't think it's worth making that big a deal of. But yeah, it wasn't a smart move, but it's over. It's done. Win more ball games, win the division.
Yeah. I mean, if this is June, this is May, you probably sit him down, let him think about it a little bit.
Sure.
But you know what? They're in a tight race. As of right now, there's 12 games left. You need his bat, and it hasn't been a very good bat, but you need Wilson Contreras and his energy and the potential that he has at the plate up there, and you need him to do good things for you, and hopefully he learns a lesson, and hopefully the way Joe said it, by showing his displeasure, doing it publicly, hopefully that was everybody going, man, that mad. We all better get it together.
Well, yeah, I mean, that certainly got my attention, the way he reacted, because, you know, usually Joe is a player's coach in that aspect, but you saw the quote that he had about it, and it's like, whoa, I didn't expect him to say that.
But yeah, so, you know, we're recording this on Tuesday night. Tonight is game two of the Diamondbacks series, which it's weird. Both of us were really looking at this series as a really tough one for the Cubs and could be a defining one for their season. But man, Arizona took a nosedive.
Yeah, there's still two games though. Things can change really quickly, but I was very pleased with the way the Cubs played the first game. Kyle Hendricks pitched a gem. They hit the ball out of the ballpark. They played some good defense outside of a few miscues. But yeah, I mean, just keep doing that. That's what will win you games. I still can't take this Arizona team lightly. That stadium has seen a lot of things go bad for the Cubs. But, you know, at least it was a promising start the first game.
Yo, I'm definitely not writing this team off. It's just we caught them at the right time. A couple weeks ago, this is going to be a barn burner game that you're going to have to hit a bunch of runs, even with good pitchers up there. But yeah, they've really struggled as of late and went from the division lead to third in the division. So they're still got a good team.
Are barely even there right now.
Yeah, they're on life support. I mean, if you look statistically, Colorado's chances are pretty slim too, because here come the Dodgers. But yeah, it's hopefully the Cubs can take advantage of a team that's just really struggling and hopefully take 3-3, but if not, at least 2-3. Because as it stands right now, there's 12 games left, including tonight's, and the magic number is down to 10.
Yeah, I mean, it's crunch time now. You have a 2.5 game lead as we're talking, and you hope that that magic number can just shrink by the day. Whether it's a Cubs win or a Brewers loss, you want that number going down every day in some form, just because of how tight it is. I mean, a few games swing and suddenly the Brewers are in first place. I mean, that could change pretty quickly, but the other thing that could change quickly is a magic number going down. So you hope for that.
Yeah, the Cardinals are quickly fading away, but I mean, we're in a tough spot here. Do we root for the Cardinals because they could really help their chances to make the playoffs, but hurt Milwaukee's chances? I hate rooting for St. Louis. I guess I'm going to root for Cincinnati and Pittsburgh because hopefully those teams can be the ones that just really beat down Milwaukee and help chip away at that magic number.
Well, this is why, at the end of the day, the Cubs just got to win. I mean, it's almost at the point where you just say, as long as the Cubs win, they're fine. So that's what you hope for. You just hope they win games. And you don't have to rely on other teams losing or winning.
Yeah, but with 12 games left and you need to win 10 to do it on your own.
Well, it's not going to happen on your own, obviously, but it would. More games the Cubs win, the easier it is. Let's say that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the more they win, it's A, better for them, and B, it puts more pressure on Milwaukee, and who doesn't seem to be buckling under the pressure because you had Yelich had his second cycle of the season.
That's a guy I wish who was on the Cubs.
Yeah, yeah. But hopefully this day off helps them. And luckily, you know, we're getting Jason Hayward back. I think he was playing tonight.
Yeah.
I think Joe said this morning. So it's hopefully that's a boost. Hopefully it gives them a rain delay talk.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, call me crazy, but I think they're in for a real tough series with the White Sox. I know that sounds crazy, but look how much better the White Sox have been playing. And I mean, you know, they often play some of their best baseball when they're playing the Cubs. So that's not going to be an easy series, I don't think, by any means. Call me crazy, but
my hope for that series is that Hawk Harrelson comes down to the field and fights John Lackey for the seventh inning stretch.
Now that I would pay to see.
That would be the best. Both of them red-assed.
They're both wearing their hats.
Oh, God. The two of them. Hawk Harrelson. The guy is like, isn't that series the last one he's doing is the Cubs?
I think it is.
And it's his last series, and he can't just, I think he's doing the whole series, and he can't just not be angry at the Cubs. I hope they kick the Cubs' ass.
Yep. Oh, he said that the other week. So, you know,
Hawk Harrelson. I don't know if you even.
Yeah, I'm personally going to be not tuning into that broadcast. Oh, yeah, but that's definitely just me.
Old red ass. Did you have any?
I don't want to listen to a bunch of anti-Cubs stuff. You know, I just, no thanks.
He's just bitter and small about it. It's, you know, I get it. There's like a line of I'm being competitive and I want my team to win and beat the other team. Sure. But he just takes it to like a childish level.
Yeah. And I just don't want to hear it.
Yeah. Especially, you know, considering that where the White Sox are in their rebuild and where the Cubs are in the standings. You know, this isn't really a rivalry right now. It is and it isn't. This is the Cubs just need to take care of business. The White Sox are trying to, save some face.
Play spoiler.
Yes, play spoiler and save some face at the end of the season. You know, next year or the year after, this is going to be a much better series. But right now, it's, you know, you're tuning in to watch the Cubs hopefully chip away that magic number.
Yeah, I mean, that's all I'm really concerned about. I don't care about beating the White Sox, you know, because it's the White Sox. I just want them to win games so they could wrap this up and clinch a postseason berth. And by the way, their postseason number is 7. So, you know, at least that's looking good. But yeah, you know, I want them to wrap it up as quickly as they can. And, you know, I just want them to keep winning games. It's, I'm not going to be like, oh, we got to beat the White Sox Crosstown Cup. I don't care about that. I don't.
Yeah.
So I just, you know, you want to do it for the sake of them winning the division, hopefully winning the division.
And statistically, like the probabilities, there's an 87% chance that the Cubs win the division, which makes me feel a little better, but still that magic number is double digits, and I don't like that.
Yeah, and I think they're at least their postseason chances are like around 99%. They got to be.
I think they're 99.9.
Yeah. I mean, it would take something incredibly drastic for them not to be playing in the postseason. But, I mean, let's face it, we want them to win the division and not have to deal with a coin flip game because, A, you know, one thing could go bad and your season's over. And, you know, okay, this is kind of my opinion. I don't know how you feel about it. I can't remember if I asked you this question or I asked it on the other show, but I'll ask it again. And if I asked it already, just remind me. I see the wild card game as a postseason play-in. I don't really see it as postseason.
Yeah, that wasn't this show, but I 100% agree. It's exciting when your team is not in it. When your team is in it, it is the most nerve-wracking experience ever. But it is, I look at it as a play-in game to make it to the playoffs.
I mean, okay, let's face it. If you make the wild card game and you lose, do you really feel like you made the postseason? No,
because you're not in a series. You're one game and it's so close to the end of the season that, you know, by the time that everyone's ready for the postseason, you've already been eliminated.
Right. So the true wild card teams are the ones that win the wild card game. You say, okay, there's the wild card. They won the wild card game, so they're the wild card team going the division series. And I know it is technically postseason, the wild card game. I know it is, but I just don't really see it as that. It's just the way I see it.
But I am excited to watch at least the AL play-in game.
Oh, that's going to be great.
Yankees versus, you know, the big bad Yankees and the, you know, under the radar Oakland A's, that is going to be a great game.
I think a lot of people are excited for that game. A lot of baseball fans are looking forward to it.
Oakland has 90 wins already.
That's amazing. The Oakland A's with a pitching staff of Trevor Cahill, Edwin Jackson, and like a few other guys.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people talk about, oh, the Indians are running away with the division, and they look, you know, you look at the Indians as a postseason threat. If they were in the same division, the Oakland A's would be up by 6.5 games on them.
I'm pretty sure that the Indians are the only above 500 team in that AL Central right now.
Oh, yeah. They're absolutely only the only above 500 team.
Because, like, second place Minnesota is, like, already well below 500.
Yeah, they're 69 and 81.
Sheesh. And they're in second place.
Yeah. So, I mean, they have, you know, there's probably no way that they don't finish below 500. I mean, they would have to win every single game for the rest of the season to even be 500.
Yeah. I mean, if you kind of look at the trends, you could see almost every team but the Indians and probably Minnesota, but you'd see three 90-plus loss teams in that division and four 80-plus loss teams. Obviously, 80-plus can still technically mean 500, but I don't think they're going to reach 500. With the number of games left, if they win maybe a few more, you know, maybe half of them, they'd still only win like 75, 76 games, the Twins would. So that's your second place team, and you have three other 90-plus loss teams. That's not a good division at all. And the very bottom one, Kansas City, probably going to reach 100 losses. They're at 98 losses now.
Yeah, they're 98 losses. They're going to hit 100 losses. Detroit's at 89 losses. They will hit 90. The White Sox are at 90. They will not hit 100, but they're at 90 already. And the Twins are at 81 losses, and you know, you got to figure they're going to be close to 90. I'm going to guess if they play their regular season percentages that, you know, they're going to hit 87, 88 losses, and that's just a bad division.
Yeah. I think the Twins will be around 75, 76 wins when it's all said and done. One quick standings note outside that division. Boy, if you want to talk about historically bad, look at the bottom of.
Thank you. I was so glad. I was going to bring it up. I'm glad you did. The Orioles are so bad. They have 12 games left, and they already have 107 losses. This is my favorite part of the standings. Is there's 12 games left, and they are 60 games out of first place.
Wild card games back, they're a little closer, 47.
They are 60 games out of first place.
Look at the White Sox. I mean, the White Sox have been playing so much better recently, but you saw that ugly first half they had. They're 24 games back in a bad division, and they're going to lose probably around 95 games. Or they've at least lost 90. They're 24 back. And then you look at Baltimore, that 60 back. I mean, wow, what a difference.
The White Sox have been record-wise pretty bad this year. They got 90 losses so far. And if they were in the same division, they would be 16.5 games ahead of the Orioles.
Ugh. Woof.
And we talk about how bad the Royals are, like, epically just absolute bottom barrel team, and they're 9 games above the Orioles.
That's crazy. You want to know what else is crazy on another spectrum? Tampa Bay is going to finish above 500. The team with 4 starters and like a beginner starter for the first inning.
The beginner starter cracks me
up. They have 83 wins now. They could flirt with like 88, 89, close to 90 wins. That's crazy. There was a time where I thought they were going to be the worst team in baseball.
But they're still 19.5 games out of first.
Well, that's what happens when Boston has 103 wins already.
Hopefully when it's all said and done, that the Boston and the Orioles have the exact inverse records.
Oh, wouldn't that be something?
That would be my favorite thing of baseball.
You know, fun little factoid, as we talk before the second game of the Cubs-Arizona series, the Cubs have as many wins now as the 03 Cubs had their entire season, 88 wins. So if you remember back to 03, that team won 88 games all season.
There you go.
So,
all right. Go ahead.
Quick question, just a little opinion question. When you think of the 2003 Cubs, do you see them as a really good team, or do you see them as not that great of a team that had a few players that just got hot at the right time? How do you see them? Just putting in perspective that Cubs team with the Cubs teams of now.
I mean, it's, if I look at them now, yeah, I look at them as a bunch of, I mean, you had some really good upstart players and you had some veterans that were clicking, you know, but at the time I thought they were just a really good team. And I'm pulling up the roster right now and man, it's not that good of a roster.
No, because look, yeah,
Eric Kairos, Damian Miller, Mark Grzelcyk, Alex Gonzalez, Aramis Ramirez, Moises Alou, Corey Patterson, Sammy Sosa. Your backups are Paul Bacco, old Kenny Lofton, Hee-Sop Choi, Troy O'Leary, Tom Goodwin, Mark Bellhorn, Randall Simon, Doug Glanville, Tony Womack.
I totally forgot Tony Womack was on that team at some point.
You know, and then your pitchers, Pryor, Zambrano, Matt Clement, Kerry Wood.
Rotation was great.
Sean Estes, Juan Cruz, Todd Wellmeyer, Sergio Mitre, Kyle Farnsworth, Antonio Fonseca.
Say my man. Joe, say my man's name.
Joe Borowski.
Yes.
Mike Remlinger.
Oh, I liked him too.
Oh, man.
But okay, let's face it though. That bullpen as a whole was not good.
No.
And it really didn't have that much depth on the team either. You had your slugger in Sammy Sosa. Alou was a very good player. You brought in Lofton and Ramirez later in the season. I mean, Lofton was pretty good, but he was old. Ramirez was obviously good. But, you know, other than that, there was just a lot of... It wasn't a terrible team by any means, but it wasn't that good. And, I mean, let's face it, they barely won the division by the skin of their teeth. Everything just kind of lined together, which you got to give them a lot of credit for. And there was significant talent on that team, but you compare that to the team that won the World Series or pretty much most of the Joe Maddon era, it doesn't even come close.
Yeah, I mean, look at their starting pitching. You said they're great starting pitching, but I think even that's kind of a looking at it as a through rose-colored glasses. Zambrano was 13-11 with a 3.11 ERA. Kerry Wood was 14-11 with a 3.2 ERA. Matt Clement was 14-12 with a 4.11 ERA. Sean Estes was 8-11 with a 5.73 ERA. It was Mark Pryor was the good one, 18-6 with a 2.43 ERA. It was Mark Pryor was the absolute ace there.
He was. I get you also got to throw in Kerry Wood. Yeah, a 3.20 ERA, it's pretty good. It's not like amazing, but he did lead the league in strikeouts. So at least he was worth something there as well. But yeah, I mean, Mark Pryor was obviously the far and away best guy on that team. And his talent really kind of reflected throughout that whole season. A lot of people, when they talk about 03, I would argue the first player that comes up when you think about that team is Mark Pryor.
Yeah, but Kerry Wood had four complete games that year. Pryor had three, Zambrano had three, Clement had two, Estes had one.
Wasn't that towards the end of the season too?
I don't remember.
Because if I remember correctly, Sean Estes pitched like a gem in Cincinnati, and that was helping them clinch. Maybe it was earlier. Maybe it was around the end of the season. I don't remember. I just remember he had one just gem of a game, and that people remembered that.
Look at this. So Zambrano had a 1.318 whip. Estes had 1.74 whip. Not that great.
Yeah, Zambrano, I mean, he didn't, from what I remember that year, I mean, he had good stuff. He didn't get hit hard, but he walked a lot of people.
His walk per nine was 4. Strikeouts per nine was 7.
Yeah, the walks are a bit high. Yeah.
Pryor was 2 walks per nine and 10.4 strikeouts per nine. Yeah,
that's really good.
Yeah. Kerry Wood was 4.3 to 11.3. They had a lot of strikeouts on that team.
Yeah, they did.
But the FIPs were Pryor 2.47, Zambrano 3.47, Wood 3.71, Clement 4.14. And my man Sean, 5.04 FIP.
Yeah. So Pryor, who was really good, and then some solid, and then some not so great.
Yeah, I think it's a sort of rose-colored glasses that we look through on that team.
Well, I mean, it was the only division winner between 1989 and 2008, and the only team that won a postseason series for like a century, so... You know, you got to give him credit there. But yeah, I mean, it was a team that really kind of got hot at the right time. And you look at the Cubs now, they reach that same win total and are most likely going to exceed it. I doubt they lose every game the rest of the season. But yeah, they're most likely going to exceed that. And you know, it's just amazing how the perspective on the Cubs changes now.
The problem with that 2003 team was, where was their Dwight Smith? Where was their Jerome Walton?
Yeah, I mean, you had the young phenom in Pryor, but everyone else pretty much did their thing. You knew Sosa was going to be a slugger. You knew what you had in Moise Salou. The guys you acquired them for a reason. You knew who they were. Yeah, I mean, there really was no random outstanding player.
No, but it's funny. What the hell happened to Mark Pryor? I mean, Jerome Walton and Dwight Smith, those guys just shined bright and then faded fast.
That 89 season has always been referred to as a fluke. And I could kind of see why, studying what happened that season.
The boys of Zimmer.
Which is funny because that team still had 3 Hall of Famers on it.
It did. But it was still, it was more of a miracle than anything else. It was like one of those just came out of nowhere. Whereas the teams now for the Cubs, they're just like the expectations are there because it's sustained. You know, the Cubs never really sustained it before. It came out of nowhere, who did this, and then just, you know, went back into obscurity.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you look at the 1989 team and the 1998 team. You go from 1985 to 2002, like what, 98 and 89, if I remember correctly, were like the only teams that were even above 500 in that span.
Yeah, I don't remember. But
there was a lot of bad. We know that.
Yeah. Let's see. So... The year before the 2003 season, they won 67 games.
Oh, I forgot. 2001, they did go above 500.
Yeah. But so they 2003, they won 88 games. 2004, 89 games. And then they went down 79, 66. And in 89, they won 93 games. But the year before and the year after, they won 77.
Yeah, there you go.
In fact, Here's the, let's see, 89 was 93. Before that, 77, 76, 70, 77. And then, before that was 84, which they won 96. But after the 89 season, went 77, 77, 78, 84, 49. So, yeah, it just came out of nowhere.
Yeah. Funny how that happens.
All right. Should we move over to talk about this Chicago Bears team?
Yeah, this is probably the thing that most people are waiting to listen to.
So we made them wait for a while. So I'm going to jump into this. I was a Jay Cutler apologist. I was a Rex Grossman apologist. I was a Kyle Orton apologist. And I have vowed I am not going to be a Mitchell Trubisky apologist. But this is like a Sir Mix-a-Lot big but. I am also not going to be a meatball about it. So everybody is lambasting Mitch Trubisky, and it's basically because we traded up to get him, and in people's minds, we could have had Deshaun Watson or Patrick Mahomes. And here's the thing is Mitchell Trubisky is in the second game of his second season. He had 200 yards, two TDs, and two interceptions. And one of the interceptions was a deflection and an amazing catch that I would have thrown the challenge flag on. But it is what it is. And he had 24 rushes. His offense put up 17 points and they got the win. And he was 25 of 34 in his completions. Now, one of the other guys that you're like, oh, they're so stupid for not picking him, is Deshaun Watson. He threw for more yards, but he had a lower completion percentage, and they threw roughly the same passes, but completion percentage. He threw two touchdowns as well, one interception, and 44 yards rushing, but his team only scored 17 points as well, and he is in the second season under this offensive system. So he has had a whole year under it and had the whole offseason to digest it. And his team got the loss. So, I mean, it's not night and day difference here. Patrick Mahomes is another thing. And Patrick Mahomes is going to come to reality. He is not going to be throwing 400 yards and four touchdowns. Just like Ryan Fitzpatrick is not going to keep up throwing 400 yards and four touchdowns. Is they all come back to reality. And they're all going to have ups and downs because they're young players. And we just have to be somewhat realistic. You know, if you look at the same point in their career, second game into their second season, in the first two games of his second season, Peyton Manning had thrown four interceptions. Two games playing into his second season, Tom Brady had zero touchdowns and had a high of 168 yards passing in a game. So that means it was of the two games, that was his high mark, 168 yards passing. And those guys are surefire lock Hall of Famers. You got to pump your brakes because being a quarterback in this league, very few guys come in, hit the ground running, and stay there forever. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, those are all fair things to say. I think that not being an apologist and not being a giver-upper, so to speak, is the right way to go because you can't give up on him yet, but he's still an unknown. He may work out, he may not. So don't take right now as the time to make a sure decision. But I'd be lying if I said there are things that I really would love to see him improve upon, because there are. He was not great last night, but he did do some great things. I think that's fair too, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely fair. Is, you know, there was a bunch of times where you just wanted to break your television, and there's other times you wanted to hoist him up on your shoulders, and that's what happens when you have a rookie essentially a rookie quarterback. Because he still hasn't played 16 games.
Right. You have essentially a rookie quarterback. You have a first-year head coach. And you have a lot of guys still trying to... It seems like they haven't really found their full mojo yet. But go and watch the scoring drives that they had. The first drive of the game when Trubisky shovel passed over to Burton for the touchdown. And what was, in my opinion, Trubisky's best throw of the game... the touchdown pass to Anthony Miller in the end zone. Look at those two drives. Those two drives were pretty much what we've wanted to see this Bears team do consistently. They were mixing things up. Mitch was making some good throws, a little bit of running, a little bit of throwing. You had some throwing downfield. You had, you know, some shorter play. You saw a nice mix of, you know, different things. And you see a team that could potentially be very good and very versatile in an offensive system, really. You saw that. But there were a lot of drives where you didn't see a lot of success. But if you can build on the positives from those good drives that they had, then you can see more of that happen more often. I truly believe that. They really just got to kind of find their niche here. There's a lot of work to be done. A lot of work.
One of the Bears beat writers shared, it was after we had recorded already, so couldn't talk about it, but shared a still of the game film where it looks like Mitch Trubisky is missing a wide open receiver in the end zone in week one. And people have been beating up Mitch Trubisky about this. And yeah, you can beat him up about a lot of stuff. Missing open guys when he throws it, overthrowing people, you know, not staring with him staring down receivers or not going to, you know, second or third options on reads. But the play in question, it is really deceiving. Is, you know, that right there is the difference between college and pros. Because high school, college, if you're a quarterback with a good arm, yeah, you can hit that all day long. In the NFL, that is an interception. In fact, the one of the defensive backs from Green Bay even defended Trubisky and said, that's us baiting him. That's an interception all day long. We intercept that every time.
Yep.
And it's true. That window closed so fast. It was, and that's the difference that between being in the league for 10 plus years and being, you know, not even having a complete season under your belt. And it's those experiences is part of figuring out quarterbacking is figuring out what other guys can do and what you can do with your arm. You know, in college, guys are going to be a lot more open, a lot easier to hit big plays. In the NFL, the windows aren't that open, and guys have a second gear where they can, you know, throw it. Look at Russell Wilson. Russell Wilson has been in the league for a good while now, and he threw that ball in the flat, and it got jumped on by Prince Amukamara, and was the difference between them being in the game and them being out of the game.
Yeah, I think you said it perfectly. It is a deceiving photo, and it's easier said than done. Though, you know, there are obviously other things that Trubisky does or doesn't do that's pretty obvious that he needs to work on. And, you know, now's the time to perfect it. But, yeah, I'm glad you brought that picture up because that has generated a lot of conversation.
Yeah, I think we'll get more into Trubisky in a minute, but I kind of want to jump into talk about the different sides of the ball. And we'd be, you know, bad at this if we didn't start with the defense. Is overall, that defense looked stifling and fantastic. But I'm going to nitpick a little bit. You know, that front seven was just as good as, I mean, there's really no chinks in that armor. And if I'm being perfectly honest, Roquan Smith was the weak link in that front seven. And that is not a knock on Roquan Smith. It is, you know, he had a couple of plays where he took a bad angle and missed a tackle. A couple of plays where he didn't in the zone, he wasn't where he was supposed to be. But he was a holdout player. That's a rookie. But when he was, it was instincts and getting to the ball. Wow. And I think he made Danny Trevathan better, which is pretty impressive because he's good as it is.
Yeah, Danny Trevathan, he had a really good game last night. I thought that was a very impressive showing by him. He had two sacks, looked really good. I asked on Twitter, I did a poll, and I asked, who was your player of the game in their win over Seattle? And I had an other specify section, but the other three guys I listed were defensive players. And I said Trevathan, Prince Amukamara, and Khalil Mack. 65% voted for Khalil Mack, and only 12% voted for Trevathan. But I thought Trevathan had a very nice game.
I voted in that poll, and I put Khalil Mack. And here's my reasoning. Was he the most dominating player in that game? Maybe. But statistically, he didn't have the best game. And that is not a knock on him. It's just everybody had a really good game. I put Khalil Mack because he made everybody yes. better. Everybody played better. Is Leonard Floyd played better. Roy Robertson Harris played better. Akeem Hicks played better. Eddie Goldman played better. Danny Trevathan played better. Everybody played better because Khalil Mack is there. And Khalil Mack did not disappoint. Is that strip sack was, you know, it was beautiful watching it live. It was even more beautiful watching it in slow motion. But the most beautiful is, I forgot who tweeted it out, but somebody tweeted out a still of the actual, when he put his hand on the ball and was getting ready to rip it away. That was a thing of beauty. It's the offensive lineman did every single thing right. Everything right, was in the right position, didn't get beat. Khalil Mack basically spun and just put his arm out and just, you know, it was like a magnet to the ball and yoink. It was like, you know, there's nothing you could have done to stop that from happening.
Yeah, no, that was an amazing play. And the thing is, he makes it look so freaking easy. That's what's amazing about it.
The funny part is, so 2 for 2 this in game after games this season, a certain John Gruden has in his post-game press conference said, we need to figure out a way to generate more pass rush.
Honestly, if I were a Raiders fan, I would wipe off my silver makeup, throw my giant spike shoulder things, and just quit. Like, I'd be done with that team.
It's unfair for John Gruden, and it's disingenuous for him to say, well, Khalil Mack didn't want to be here. Khalil Mack just wanted to get paid. Is you make a deal, you sign the guy, and you bring him in. Is maybe not sign some of those other 85 over-the-hill guys that you have and pay the guy who's good. I don't know if you saw the thing I tweeted out during the game, or is it after the game? Somebody put together a film reel of the guy who actually is replacing Khalil Mack. And there's one play where he just kind of stops and stands around and looks around. Doesn't do anything. And you have that guy when you could have had Khalil Mack.
Oof. Again, I am so thankful for John Gruden right now. So thankful.
Everybody is at first people before the trade happened, there was all kinds of articles talking about, anybody that trades 2 first rounders for Khalil Mack needs and then has to pay him is going to need their head checked. And after seeing him after 2 games, everybody in the world is going, man, worth every penny and every bit of draft equity that you gave up for him.
Well, absolutely. I don't think there's any doubt there. There should be zero doubt that was worth it at this point. He's that good.
Yes. Yes. Is again, I go back to your draft picks are, I mean, imagine trading Kevin White and Mitch Trubisky for Khalil Mack. Do you do that?
Yeah.
Everybody does that. 100% of people do that. And that is having a number 2 pick and a 7 pick. And the Bears will not be drafting 2 or 7 this year. I'm not saying they're going to be drafting 30th, but they're going to be drafting in at least the 15 to, you know, 16 range at least. So, you know, those picks aren't going to be anywhere near as valuable as they were the last several years.
Yeah. I mean, they're moving forward with their plan here. you're trying to win now. You're trying to find success on the field. Obviously, for many years, you were trying to rebuild, so you wanted as many draft picks as you can get. But you know, times are different now. They're trying to go for it.
Yeah, absolutely. But going back to the defense, the safeties really improved their play from week one. That was the biggest improvement from week one. And week one was a pretty good defensive performance. There was definitely the second half breakdowns, but the safeties definitely improved. It's the corners where they still need to improve.
Yeah, no doubt.
And it wasn't that there was a lot bad. It was, I think they just need to be more aware of where the first down markers are. With knowing the pass rush that they have in front of them, that they shouldn't leave such a big cushion for wide receivers. And Kyle Fuller in, especially, he needs to make sure he's turning his head. And I know it's a hard thing to do because very few corners are turning their head on deep routes, but he's back-to-back games where he's gotten burned by an absolute perfect throw. The one with Geronimo Allison from week one, that was a perfect throw, and there was absolutely nothing he could have done. The one that was thrown from to Tyler Lockett from Russell, Russell Wilson, that one was a good throw, but had he turned his head, he could have defended that or intercepted it. It was a very, very, very good throw,
it was a great
but that
catch,
was definitely too. A playable. It was a great catch, great throw, but he had good coverage. He could have done something had he, turned his head.
Yeah, you just hope that kind of thing gets better because, the front seven is going to do a lot of work trying to keep constant pressure on the quarterback, but you need your secondary to be good as well. I mean, you saw later in the game when Wilson was finding open targets downfield and the front seven wasn't getting to him quite as often, he was able to hit them. I don't really count the last touchdown because that was just garbage time and they weren't really, but the other drive, I should say, like you were talking about. But yeah, it definitely a place to improve upon would be the secondary, I think. Though, like, the safeties, while they played better, secondary as a whole still needs some improvement.
Yeah, I mean, there was one play, though, that I really got to hand it to Eddie Jackson, is there was a deep throw to the, right around the goal line, right by the pylon, and he closed so quick to break up that pass, and that was very Brian Dawkins-ish. And hopefully we start seeing more plays like that because that's what I expect out of Eddie Jackson. And I think he's capable of it. He's just got to keep working on it and keep doing those types of things.
Exactly.
But as far as the defense goes, again, Russell Wilson is going to have nightmares about this defensive line. They, for the most part, all game long played meet you at the quarterback. And it wasn't one guy. It was Russell Wilson was getting from the left side, the right side, up the middle. And sometimes there were blitzes. It was just every angle that guy was just getting the pressure. And that's great news. The Bears, after two games, have the most sacks in the NFL, the most pressures in the NFL. And hopefully that continues.
Absolutely. I mean, that's going to be the biggest strength of the defense is pressure on the quarterback. We went from having weakness in the pass rush to having arguably the best. So you got to keep using that throughout the season.
But the thing is, teams are going to start scheming for this defense. You saw, there are some chinks in the armor, and you saw Green Bay start to do it in the second half. You saw glimmers of it. Hints of it with Seattle, but basically it's take that pass rush away by quick passes. And in also running right at the outside linebackers, which expends more energy on their part. But the way to defend that honestly is you've got to have aggressive cornerbacks, and Prince Amukamara showed you how you make them pay for doing that. Is they either got to let the play develop, and in which case Khalil Mack and Akeem Hicks are, getting to you, or you do quick passes and that, you know, shrinks the number of routes that people run. It's not a time for a double move. It's going to be a single move, and there's very limited tree routes that you can run, and you jump them. You jump those routes, and that's what Prince Amukamara did. That interception wasn't his instincts. That wasn't his veteranness. That wasn't just him being good. That was absolutely watching a lot of film and listening to his coaches. Is Prince Amukamara made them pay for that type of game plan. And that's how you make them pay.
He read that pass so perfectly. I mean, it was just a thing of beauty.
I mean, and that's the thing is when you're going to do these quick passes to try to slow down the pass rush is, you know, you don't give the wide receiver enough time to do these, you know, intricate patterns and such. It is usually a quick one move route, and you've got to learn that route tree. You've got to know the other team's route tree inside and out if you're a cornerback, and be prepared to jump it based on formation, based on guys that are in the game, and be able to jump those routes. And once you start doing that, it makes the other team question doing that type of play, and it really puts them in a bind. Well, we can't do short passes. We can't run the ball, and we can't take a long time to let these plays develop, because we've got, you know, these absolute ogres coming in and just destroying our offensive linemen.
This is my swamp.
So the only knock I can have is the front seven. Well, the front four got winded by the end of the game.
Well, you saw Khalil Mack huffing and puffing on the side.
Yeah. So they just got to get into better conditioning. And those things happen when you miss all of training camp. Hopefully they can get it together in the next couple of weeks. And, in a game when you really need them to come through in the fourth quarter. But overall, this defense has been stifling.
Yeah, you got to love what you've seen. And again, I don't really count that last Seattle drive. It was just kind of prevent defense garbage time. So, you know, that was kind of whatever. But yeah, I can't really disagree with anything you said there. I really, really did like the way that, especially in the first half, it just felt like every single time Wilson had the ball, someone was coming at him. Somebody was. There was a real nice rhythm in the first half. And like you said, you know, once they get into kind of more conditioned shape to go throughout a full game, then, you know, you're going to see it be even better.
Absolutely. Moving on to the offense, is the offensive side of the ball has a long way to go.
Yes.
They need to get Mitch more comfortable in this offense. Is those scripted plays, is Mitch looks good. It's when the plays aren't scripted, he gets dancy feet and things aren't as good. And that just shows me that just his level of understanding of the offense and his command of it isn't where it needs to be. And that's what happens with a complicated offense and a young player. It's going to get better. And again,
those growing pains.
It's growing pains. And whether or not he's going to be good or bad, I can't say, but the growing pains are going to be there either way. The good thing is you can tell by certain plays, like, when there was a close game and they came out and they were letting Mitch throw, some hot routes there. Matt Nagy absolutely trusts Mitch Trubisky, which is good. He hasn't lost any trust in his quarterback.
Which is important.
And that's an absolute good thing. The one thing this team really needs to improve on is they need to improve on their power running game.
I agree. You have a great guy in Jordan Howard, and I think Matt Nagy's still trying to gain more trust in him, which I don't see why that needs to be the case. He's really good, but I don't know.
Your offensive line is at its best when it's power rushing and leading the way for Jordan Howard. is let that happen, is let him, let Jordan Howard do his thing, let that offensive line do their thing. And honestly, is when, once the offensive line starts dictating to the defensive line what's happening, which usually occurs by running the ball, is they wear down that defensive line and makes for better pass protection. It's just an absolute fact. So Matt Nagy needs to be leaning more on Jordan Howard, giving him more carries, running more power run game, is because when it goes to third and shorts, fourth and shorts, they have these long developing plays, and they've gotten most of them, but you've got to have faster developing plays, and you've got to be able to just go up there and smash the ball and power through. So that's something that Matt Nagy needs to work on, and that's on him.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know that Jordan Howard isn't a traditional quote unquote Matt Nagy guy who's a passer first type guy, but you know, the importance of having a power guy like Jordan Howard is still very much there in the NFL, especially on the situations you talked about. At least we saw Howard on more third downs this time than the week before. So I want to hope and say that there's at least a growing usage of him there and that it'll continue to grow. That's at least my hope. But you just look at what Jordan Howard can do, and like, man, why would you not want to take advantage of that?
I mean, look at that series when they ran almost every time. Is they ran so much time off the clock, they just wore down that defense, and it gave your defense more time on the sideline to rest.
Yeah, that's important.
Another thing that they need to work on is they've got to get Trey Burton involved more in the offense. He got the touchdown, but he was pretty silent after that.
Wasn't that kind of the same thing in game one, too? You saw him all over the field in the first drive, and then not much of him after that.
Yeah, you got to get him involved. Allen Robinson looked fantastic, but it was all short routes. I think you need to utilize him taking away a safety in deeper coverage.
I agree.
And letting him have use his abilities to stretch the field. And I think that's what you need to do. He shouldn't be a possession receiver. He should be a deep receiver.
There were too few many check downs and bubble screens for my liking. I mean, obviously there's a place for them from time to time, but you know, you would hope that you'd see a bit more of the utilizing downfield, throwing downfield more. And we just haven't seen much of that yet. I don't know if there's a trust issue or what, but I want to see more of that.
And now we'll get to Mitch Trubisky. We kind of alluded to a lot of this before, but he had happy dancy feet, and he did not stay in the pocket long enough on some passing downs, and just went and ran for it. And I get it. He's an athletic guy. He's going to pick up the yards, but he's got to watch tape of Aaron Rodgers. Aaron Rodgers stays in that pocket until the last minute, and if he needs to, he'll run to make you pay, but he feels, and he knows, and everybody else knows, he's way more dangerous in the pocket. And that's where Mitch Trubisky needs to get to that point.
Yeah. Right on. There were a lot of instances where you thought, man, if he could have hit that open target downfield, they could have put up at least two more touchdowns on the board last night.
Yeah, they need to work on putting teams away. But Mitch Trubisky, not all the time, but there are times when he stares down his receiver, and that's going to get him in trouble. You can't do that in the NFL. His passes in the first half of the game were really high, and that usually is nerves when you go in there and you start throwing everything high. A lot of times you'll attribute that to nerves, and that's kind of a standard thing. And you'll see guys that throw high to begin with start to bring the ball back down as the game goes on and they feel a little more confident. But, you know, the more high passes he throws like that, the more nervous he's going to get because he hasn't had prior success in the NFL. And, you know, you need to start completing passes to build that confidence. And, you know, Matt Nagy needs to help with that.
Yeah, no doubt. Because I think that when you see Mitch Trubisky misses guys, it's way too often the overthrowing.
And part of that is he starts seeing himself overthrow the ball. He starts shrinking his field. And a lot of his passes are within 15 yards. They're 10, 12-yard passes. And those are fine and good, but you need to stretch the field to take full advantage of this offense. And so you need to build that confidence early so he can have those deeper routes and complete those passes and not be nervous about throwing to a guy 20 yards down the field.
Yeah, that's going to be a big thing to work on.
But for all the people that are calling for, you know, Mitch Trubisky's head already, here's the fact. Mitch Trubisky is tied to Matt Nagy, who is tied to Ryan Pace. And those three guys are going to be here for at least a while. So unless there's an injury, you better get used to Mitch Trubisky because he's going to be your quarterback and there's not a controversy and you're not going to see a backup. You're not going to see Chase Daniel, you know, coming in. It's Mitch Trubisky's, even if he's bad, they're going with him.
Yeah, that's the reality of it. And there's going to have to be some patience. Obviously, again, a lot of growing pains. We'll see what happens. That's all we can do. There's no certainties, but you hope for the best.
I think my biggest criticism of Mitch Trubisky from the night is after that first pick, they cut to the sideline view. And I can't remember who it was, but somebody was trying to pass him the tablet to watch the film. And that's what you'll see Tom Brady do. That's what you'll see Ben Roethlisberger do. That's what you'll see Aaron Rodgers do. That's what you'll see all the top quarterbacks do is they are studying. They're looking. What did I do wrong? What happened here? What did I miss? And Mitch Trubisky kind of waved it off and just went back to watching the game from sitting on the bench. That bugged me. Is he's a young player. He needs to study film. If he doesn't, he will never be a success, ever.
Right, more than ever, you got to study that stuff. And I honestly didn't notice that because there were parts of the game I missed. But yeah, that's an interesting thing to point out.
But one thing is, typically by game three, other teams will have some significant film to watch when they're preparing to play you. And look at the way the offense has shifted from game one to game two and how they've played. And it makes you wonder, is there going to be a shift for game three? And if so, how do teams prepare for that when they change up the offense seemingly every week?
Well, this is one of the reasons you got Matt Nagy for. You want to see that from him. John Fox was as predictable as it gets. Teams didn't even have to watch film at that point. They basically knew what to do against a John Fox offense.
Yeah. So you've got a much more intricate offense, a much more sophisticated offense that's not predictable. And you've got an absolute stifling defense. Next week, they play the Arizona Cardinals, who are really struggling. And you have to imagine that you're going to see their rookie quarterback for that game.
Yeah, you hope that the Bears can really take advantage of that one.
Because he is not a mobile quarterback like a Deshaun Watson or Mitch Trubisky or even an Aaron Rodgers. They are going to eat him alive and he is not going to have the knowledge and experience of Russell Wilson and Aaron Rodgers to be able to, pick apart the secondary a little bit. Is, you know, Josh Rosen, if he's the starting quarterback, is going to have some growing pains himself. And most of it's going to be at the hands of a guy named Khalil Mack, just smashing his face.
Yeah.
It makes you wonder if they're if they're going to do that. And, you know, is that a smart idea to start your rookie quarterback? Even if you're in dire straits, do you start a rookie quarterback in those types of situations?
Yeah, it's a tough call, especially considering who's on that front seven.
But the crazy one for me is when I first looked at the schedule, you know, a couple weeks before the season, like really looked at the schedule, I was like, all right, the Bears have the Tampa Bay Buccaneers for game four of the season. Jameis Winston got a 3-game suspension. Yeah, crap. That means we get the first game back for Jameis Winston. That's going to make it tougher. But boy, after watching Ryan Fitzpatrick play the first two games, you're like, I hope we get Jameis Winston.
Yeah, my goodness. Ryan Fitzpatrick is playing out of his mind right now. And frankly, I'm kind of happy for the guy.
Yeah, and I got into a little bit with some people on Twitter, not like a bad way, but, you know, Ryan Fitzpatrick is here's my thing. He has had two phenomenal games. You can't take that away. But the last regular starting gig he had, his quarterback rating was a 69. It's at like a 155 now. At age 35, you don't suddenly add 100 points to your quarterback rating. It's not like, oh, I figured it out now. Even if you go back to the guy's career average, he's like an 80, 81 quarterback rating guy. Things are going to revert to the mean. He's not going to have an all-time Drew Brees, Peyton Manning type record-setting career year at age 35 when he's just been a journeyman.
Right.
That's not going to happen. He's 35 years old. I wonder what's going to happen when he has Akeem Hicks and Leonard Floyd and Khalil Mack bearing down on him.
This is a game that I think if all goes right, we could see a blowout by the Bears. Again, everything has to go right, but you know, right now I think a lot of things favor the Bears.
You got to expect the Bears are going to beat the Cardinals next week, which puts them at 2-1.
Yeah.
That's
a game
awesome.
Even more that should favor the Bears.
Yeah. And the Tampa game is, I'm interested to see how that plays out because Tampa has put up sick yards, but they've also got a lot of big plays. And when you're a big play offense like that with a 35-year-old quarterback, you feel that there's, you know, a way to defend that. And there's going to be enough film at that point where Vic Fangio is going to go into his mad scientist lab and figure that out.
Right.
I don't know if I have anything else I wanted to talk about.
No, I don't either.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we really broke this down. There's no real injuries concern, which is great considering the last few years.
2 weeks in a row, that's something.
Yeah, I mean, you got guys that are clearly, you know, got a little bangs and bruises, but no injuries, and that's a good thing.
Right, nothing serious.
Yeah. But yeah, so I can't wait to break down next week's game because hopefully they break down on Josh Rosen and smash him up good.
Yeah. That, again, I think that's going to be a matchup that's going to favor the Bears probably better than most games this regular season.
Yeah. So I think that's going to do it for this episode of Bill Swirsky Sports Talk Chicago. I want to thank everybody so much for checking out the show. Please make sure you hit us up on social media at ShyFanPat1, at Swirsky Sports. Facebook.com/Swirsky Sports, SwirskySports.com. Hit subscribe however you listen to podcasts, whether it's iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, the TuneIn app. Thank you guys so much for listening. Please share with a friend that listens to or likes Chicago sports. Let them know about this show. And thanks for listening. And until next time, bear down.
Cubs win! provider.
Cubs win! Cubs win! Cubs win!
Oh, I don't want her. You can have her. She's a Packer fan. She can't fit in my van. And she looks like...
Remember, New Yorkers, smoking crack is not legal on planes.
Bears 31 to negative 7.
The Bears!
Oh, when the Bears go bare.